Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Dave Bazanko, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week we have a debate between Dr. Joe House, reader in climate change science and policy and co-chair of the environmental change at the Cabot Institute for Environment at Bristol University, and Piers Corbin, weather forecaster and physicist. Dialect is produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you have a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
Joining me are Dr. Jo House, reader in climate change, science and policy at Bristol University. She's also co-chair of environmental change at the Cabot Institute for Environment at Bristol University. Also joining me is Piers Corbin. He's actually a weather forecaster, but he's also said a lot about climate change and has some what you could call controversial views about it. I'm going to ask you to start though, Joe. Can you just give us a bit of your background and what brought you to study this topic?
Thank you very much. I almost actually did a maths degree and then actually became very interested in environmental issues and studying environmental change. And when I started learning about climate change, I was really shocked by the scale and rate of change of things that were happening back then, which was some 25 years ago. And since then, I've studied and worked more and more on climate change. I've also been privileged to be an author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, contributing to their climate change assessments. Recently spent a year in the Government Office for Science in the UK as head of climate change advice.
And for you, Piers, can you tell us what brought you to your weather forecasting role?
Well, as a child, I was always interested in the weather, being a practical aspect of physics, and did measurements of my own and set up a weather station. Then I studied physics at Imperial College London and got a first-class degree, and then I did astrophysics as a postgraduate activity at Queen Mary College and studied solar activity there, and then realised that there were, in fact, connections whereby the sun's particle and magnetic activity drives weather. And I published some papers when I was still at school on science matters, but weather-type matters mostly. And later on, developed this method of long-range weather forecasting, which we have, which is based on solar activity with lunar effects. And this runs our business, weatheraction.com.
Can you explain, give us a bit of idea of your qualifications to speak on climate change, though?
Yes, I've got, I've had various publications, including on climate change, but I've got all the physics background, which is necessary for understanding weather and climate, and able to produce very successful long-range forecasts based on this. And the astrophysics, of course, is of great relevance to the solar input, which is not what standard meteorologists use.
Now, you say standard meteorologists. Who are they, and whereabouts will we find them? And is there any evidence that your predictions are better than theirs?
Well, the standard meteorologists would be people who run computer model predictions of weather using measurements of the atmosphere and how those would move forwards in time. Basically, the view being the weather causes weather. And all the Met Offices in the world would be this sort of thing.
But Piers, is there any evidence that you're able to predict the weather better than they can?
Oh, absolutely. There's a peer-reviewed independent papers which show that we are significantly skilled, and we publish forecasts which farmers buy and buy and buy, and so do various other businesses, like those who are engaged in commodity trading, for example, use our forecasts to predict what's going to happen some months ahead and then take advantage of it.
In a nutshell, what do you put that down to?
The reason for our success is our understanding of the sun-earth magnetic links and been able to apply predictable aspects of solar activity from a long time ahead to weather forecasts.
So okay.
We can make weather forecasts, for example, the very hot spells during the summer, we predicted those at least 5 months ahead.
What about the main topic for this evening, which is climate change? I mean, what's your position on this, Piers, before we hear from Joe House? Do you believe climate change is taking place? And if so, what is causing it?
Yeah, climate has always been changing, and it's done that for millions of years. And the changes now are interesting, but nothing special compared with the last 10,000 years, say. But we are in one of the relatively rapid periods of actually now moving into cooling of the world because of low solar activity. So we have evidence that solar activity changes do change climate, and generally low solar activity is a cooler world and high solar activity is a warmer world.
Can you explain how the sun affects the weather here and how that actually works?
Yes, we can in general terms. Mainly it's because of it affects the jet stream. And I showed in the conference in Porto, Portugal, last week that when you have low solar activity, the rush of particles from the sun has less of a grip on the Earth's magnetic shield. And that causes, for example, the average speed of the Earth, even the length of the Earth day, to change. And, of course, the atmosphere itself will have small variations which result in changes in the jet stream, which is the upper air motion of fast air in the mid latitudes.
Okay, I'll just put the same
more wavy and more north south variation.
Okay,
there's no evidence whatsoever that carbon dioxide is causing anything. Carbon
okay, well, let's get on to CO2 in a minute, but first I'd like to just put the same question to Joe as I put to you about climate change. Is it happening, Joe, and what's the evidence?
Yes, there's quite a lot of evidence about how climate's changing, from direct temperature observations to different records that we have in ice cores, in little bubbles of air trapped in ice that kind of captures past atmosphere. So we have actually a really, really strong evidence base.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the ice is keeping a memory of previous climate, and so we can actually extend our knowledge back for quite a long way and compare the present to that.
Yeah, for 400,000 years we have ice records. So as it snows, the ice becomes compacted and traps little bubbles of
air. Doesn't
the
ice melt after like 500,000 years?
No, because it becomes compacted with layer upon layer. So people take ice cores where they drill down into the ice, and as you drill down, the deeper you get in the core, you're going backwards in time. And so you can measure the air that's 400,000 years old. And through that, we can see that the rate of CO2 change and the concentration of CO2 is unprecedented in that time.
Well, that, I mean, I'm quite surprised about that. How can they actually tell how old a piece of ice is?
So you use all kinds of different ways of estimating things like isotopes of carbon and different ways of looking at the way carbon atoms decay.
Right, this is like carbon dating, the same way they do fossils and things like that.
It's a similar sort of thing. You also use that to look at the different constituents of the air in those ice bubbles to determine what temperature was.
Okay, well, look, let's just fast forward to 2018. What's happening now with our climate?
Yeah, so I'd just like to pick up on a couple of points Piers made. And I think it's weather and climate are two terms that we've been using, and weather is kind of what we're experiencing now and might happen from season to season and year to year. And climate's more about the long-term trends. And Piers is absolutely right that solar activity affects our weather and affects what we experience on a day-to-day basis. But there are also long-term trends of change, where over the last 35 years, we've seen a very clear trend of increasing global average temperatures, and increase in temperatures in Bristol that I'm sure some of your listeners will have been experiencing. And Piers also rightly says that the solar activity is actually going in the opposite direction, implying a cooling. And this is a thing we have over the last 35 years. The solar activity has been leading more towards cooling, but actually over that time, temperatures have continued to increase. and the last 3 years have continued to break different records of being the hottest on record in different places throughout the world.
Okay, so Piers, how do you answer that? You say temperatures are actually going down. Joe is saying they're going up.
Well, the satellite data, which has not been adjusted, shows temperatures going down, or at minimum it shows there's been no rise of temperatures since, say, 1989. The official organisations have adjusted temperatures and made it look as if they're going up, and they have consecutive adjustments of temperatures which make things look colder in the past and warmer at present.
Well, it sounds to me like
the actual satellite data shows we're now in a period of cooling, and the actual ice measurements show that there's now more snow and ice in both the northern and the southern hemisphere.
Perfect, because
massive ice than there has been for about 20 or 30 years.
Okay, that's perfect. You should mention ice, because that's what I was going to ask you about next, because this is one of the obvious indications of the temperature of the Earth and whether climate change is happening, what even it might indicate, and help us find out what's causing it. Because certainly my understanding, Piers, is that the ice at the North and the South Pole every year is getting less and less. It's almost like, if you can imagine...
No, that's untrue. That
if you can, it's almost, if you can imagine a cube of ice in your glass, as it cools down, your gin and tonic is getting smaller and smaller. You're saying that's not the case then?
No, it's not the case at all. Not in the last 5 years. The amount of ice, massive ice, is increasing. In the Antarctic, the only part of the Antarctic which is showing non-increase is the West Antarctica, which is got a lot of undersea, under ice and undersea volcanoes, which have increased in activity recently. And very interestingly, historically, over hundreds of thousands of years, it's clear that during periods of low solar activity, volcanic and earthquake activity does increase. I could explain the reasons for that if you wanted, but that is a fact, and that is why we have both the signs of low solar activity affecting climate, namely the wild jet stream and general cooling, and also more volcanic activity happening around the world in the last few
years. Dr. Joe House, you seem to be at odds maybe here. What do you think's happening with the ice caps at Arctic and Antarctic? Certainly my understanding was, and I may be wrong, that the ice cap, particularly the Arctic, is shrinking, and that it's becoming easier to, for example, sail a ship across the top of Russia from one side to the other at later and later in the year, because there isn't quite so much ice forming. So what's your view on that?
Exactly, and I think you make a good point of, you know, what people are experiencing. So you don't really need to rely on what scientists are telling you, actually. What people are experiencing, things like passages opening up through to Russia, things like many schools keep their own temperature records and have little weather stations. And so you can see the climate, the record of climate change from many different actual records that are different people are collecting in different places throughout the world, in rural areas and in cities. And I'm very privileged at Bristol University to work with one of the UK's and one of the world's leading glaciology centres, where I work with a lot of people who work on ice in the Arctic, in the Antarctic, and also ice in glaciers in the mountains. All those areas show very strong records of ice being lost at an unprecedented rate. But a bit like the weather, you know, we've had some very exceptional hot years. Not every year is going to be exceptionally hot. You have some years and some places in the world that aren't going to experience that incredible hotness every single year, because there's that variability. The same with ice, which is why some areas might show an increase in ice mass in some years. But overall, over a number of years and over all the ice in the world, we see a very clear loss that is increasing in rate.
Now, my own personal experience, Piers, I'm afraid, is tending to Dr. Joe House's point of view, which is, as a youngster, I can remember quite a lot of snow. Quite often now, we get entire winters with no snow.
Well, no, that isn't true. 2010 was the coldest December for 100 years, and we have had a big increase in snow since 2010, whereas the United Nations told us, or various bodies told us, we would see the end of snow. I think I have to take up these comments as well about ice. You have to look at the actual facts and actual measurements, and the simple observation that some recent green campaigns campaigners in the last 2 years attempted to get through ice in the Arctic and failed to do so and got stuck in the ice and had to be rescued. The actual measurements show that the mass of ice has gone up by a large amount in the Antarctic and a moderate amount recently. It's turned around in the Arctic.
Okay, what I'll do is I will put a couple of links on our show page to various sources, and it'd be nice if I can have some internet links from both of you at the end of the programme, and I'll put that up so people can go and have a look for themselves.
On weatheraction.com there are very many sub-links, and also my Twitter account.
But look, I'm going to move things on to look a little bit more closely at one of the other key issues here, which is the extent to which mankind is causing these changes. I don't think there's many doubts on any sides that climate is changing in one way or another. But I'll ask you first about this, Joe. Is there any evidence that the changes that we're seeing are caused by man's activity?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So lots of things affect climate, as Piers rightly said. Sunspots is one of them. Piers also mentioned volcanoes. That can affect the long-term climate and the weather we experience from day to day. And what the scientists do is they look at that. They look at sunspots. They look at volcanoes. They also look at other things that affect the climate, such as greenhouse gases. And they put all the evidence together. And they look at the natural fluxes, because, of course, carbon dioxide, methane, are natural greenhouse gases. They're produced by nature. There are sources and sinks, but the natural sources and sinks balance each other out. Yet we're seeing a rise in concentration due to the additional human-made effects. When we look at all those things together, the greenhouse gases, the sunspots, the volcanic activity, it's only by combining all of those that you're able to accurately recreate the temperatures that we've seen. So the sunspots and the volcanic activity don't do it alone. It's only when you take account of the additional effect from greenhouse gases and other aerosols.
Okay, let's just focus on these greenhouse gases. Is it methane, CO2, these kinds of things? Some of that obviously is produced by factories, coal, cars, aircraft. But then there's also, I suppose, another side of that, and that is the lack of trees, you know, the deforestation. So how do we know what's actually causing these changes?
Now, thankfully, you're touching on an area very close to my own area of research and my own passion as well, because I feel very strongly about environment and very strongly about trees and the amount of services to humankind that trees and plants do and provide us food and medicine and help recycle the water and create rainfall. So trees and plants, when they grow, they take up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and they store it as carbon in the biomass in their trunks and leaves. And when we cut them, they decay, and that carbon goes back to the atmosphere. So we can look at land cover change, we can look at the areas deforested, and from that we can calculate how much carbon dioxide from that human-induced land cover change has gone into the atmosphere. And over maybe about the past 150, 200 years, the human use of the land, that conversion of forest to agriculture, as well as other ways we're using land, has caused about a third of the carbon dioxide emissions. Over that whole period of time, obviously fossil fuel emissions have been rising even more rapidly, and the land use change has become less of the main cause. So currently, land use changes contribute to about 10% of the greenhouse gas emissions. There's also lots of greenhouse gas emissions associated with various forms of agriculture. And, you know, agriculture is important, right? We need to feed people and, you know, so that's very essential. But that comes along with different kinds of greenhouse gas emissions as well, such that overall agriculture contributes to around a quarter of all greenhouse gas emissions due to things like fertilizer use and raising livestock.
So the livestock, is that because they're breathing? I mean, one of the famous things is about, how can I politely put it?
farting. Carl's farting, is this going to be?
Yes, I think so. I mean, is this really making any difference? I mean, this is one of those things I think sometimes look at that and think, well, this is just ridiculous.
It's making no difference whatsoever.
It's one of the really surprising things, actually. And there's a really nice government, actually, one of our past government chief scientific advisors had produced a carbon calculator. And so you can go on the UK carbon calculator and you can play about with that, actually, to look at how you can change different emissions, because this isn't just all about doom and gloom, actually. It's about what people can do to make a difference. I was actually surprised doing that. It's one of the things I sometimes get my students to do, is have a play around with this, is by actually how much difference it makes in looking at diet change. And I'm not talking about everyone going on massive diets or even nobody eating meat at all, but I'm just talking about small tweaks in your diet whereby you eat less red meat, which, let's face it, is good for health as well. And it's surprising how much of a difference that can make.
I think it's also worth saying, nothing to do with necessarily with climate change, but it's just much a better use of land for people to be eating vegetarian rather than eating meat. Anyway, look, let's give Piers his say. Piers, what's your evidence or otherwise about the extent to which humanity is involved in this?
Well, first of all, you should notice that all the major predictions of the man-made climate change lobby have failed in the last 10 years. Specifically, climate scientists looking at actual data can see and show, and this is published in dozens, if not hundreds, of scientific papers in the last year or so, that the levels of carbon dioxide follow world temperatures. They do not lead them. In other words, carbon dioxide levels are an effect, not a cause, of changes in climate.
But how can you tell that? Surely, I mean, all you can do is look at the two amounts, and if they correlate...
No. You've got the actualized core data, and you can see when the temperatures went up, and then subsequently CO2 levels went up and so forth. And this is on scales of say, hundreds of years. So there's a delay of some few hundred years due to the circulation of the oceans. And the second reason why the CO2 theory is proved to fail is that man's contribution to the flux of carbon dioxide in and out of the sea and land is only 4% of the total. So if man's carbon dioxide is ruling the show, then nature has to follow man, which
so
of course
where
is
do you
a
get that figure
delusional
of,
theory.
Where do you get that figure of 4% from? I mean, I would have thought we've got quite a lot of planes, haven't we?
Yeah, I know, but they're quite small compared with the total amount of all the, you know, vegetation, animals, rotting vegetation, and so forth. No, that's an accepted figure. And of course, if things like bison were significant in terms of methane production, then of course we would have had a great hot climate at the times when America was dominated by bison until the British went there and killed most of them. But it wasn't the case. I mean, again, those type of greenhouse gases are an effect, not a cause, of CO2. But bear in mind, of course, we're normally just concentrating on the CO2 issue because this is what man is doing. Now, there are things that man is doing to climate by changing environment. For example, we had a very interesting paper at the conference in Porto in Portugal last week, where it's shown that the damming of the Nile has had quite an effect on cloud cover because there's less area of lake which can evaporate in the sun. And this has probably contributed to changes in climate in Africa and downwind of Africa, if you like. But the overall thing from a proper scientific analysis of the data is that CO2 levels are an effect, not a cause, of changes in climate.
And
we have is a politically driven activity, which the oil companies like because they can justify increasing energy prices on the back of the CO2 scare.
Can you answer these questions about CO2?
On the one hand, I'm really happy to continue answering these questions. But again, I'll say Piers is right again, but I'm afraid it's not anything that's not already been taken account of in the modelling and the measuring and the calculations that have been done by climate scientists. And I will answer Piers again.
Can you let Joe speak,
please? Yeah, okay.
But what do you mean by taking account of that fact which negates...
Piers, let her finish what she's saying, please, and then you can have your say.
Okay. Thank you. So I will answer you specifically, but I will say as well, in answering you, and I'm really happy to do so, but I must say that, you know, the vast majority, overwhelming number of scientists accept that climate change is real.
And also,
Piers, please let her finish.
And I will answer your specific points, and also overwhelming number of governments in reading and agreeing to the text that comes out of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And in signing the Paris Climate Agreement, it's clear that the overwhelming majority of scientific evidence, actually all scientists and most governments accept that climate change is real. But on the specific points that Piers made, as I already said, on the carbon dioxide, as I already said, you know, land naturally is a source and sink for carbon dioxide as plants grow, and it's massive fluxes to and from the atmosphere. But they're more or less in balance over time and over the world. They're in balance. What mankind's doing is releasing that carbon that's stored on the land and releasing that carbon that's been stored for millions of years in fossil fuels into the atmosphere, and that's adding an additional burden, and it's taken things out of balance, and that's why the concentration is increasing. And that's very, very measurable, the increase in concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And the other thing that Piers was talking about was over time about whether CO2 or climate leads. And actually, then we're getting into complicated science about the way feedbacks happen. So climate warms, things decompose faster. For example, if you leave your food out of the fridge, it will decompose quicker than when it's in the fridge. So you have a balance of the earth, climate warms a little bit, things decompose faster, then release more greenhouse gases, that contributes to more warming. So you have all these feedback effects that go on. So you have, you know, it's to talk about whether climate's leading CO2 or CO2's leading climate, they're in a kind of feedback with each other. But to me, actually, we're spending a lot of time discussing the science. And actually, I think what's probably more useful here, and if Piers has scientific evidence that's peer-reviewed that he wants to submit to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for review, I'd really welcome him to do that. If he wants to come to Bristol and talk to our glaciologists about... Please don't interrupt me.
Just let her finish, Piers.
If he would like to come to Bristol and talk to our glaciologists about their evidence, I'd be really happy for that to happen. But what I'd really like to talk about is actually what people are experiencing.
Okay, well, look,
and
what
we can do about it.
We'll come to that in a minute. But Piers, have you submitted your evidence to the Intergovernmental Panel?
Well, I've written scientific papers on these matters, but have many other people.
Well, that sounds like you're saying no, you haven't.
Well, no, wait a minute. The IPCC is not a peer-reviewed organisation. It's run by government-sponsored scientists. There are people who were in the IPCC who objected to it, to their names being used in a number of ways. I think the important things that have just come up now is that the supposedly majority of scientists believe this thing. Well, even if that was true, that isn't evidence of anything at all, because opinion polls do not dictate science. And Galileo was told, of course, opinion was against him, but fortunately he stood his ground.
Well, I suppose you said, maybe you see yourself as a modern-day Galileo.
No, there's hundreds of scientists who agree with what we're saying. We call ourselves climate realists. And this figure of 97% of scientists or something believe in the CO2 theory is actually untrue. The scientific paper that produced that, or rather, which is quoted by journalists claiming that, actually had a figure of less than 3% who believed in the CO2. They did a survey of papers which showed there was a lot of people put CO2 issues or climate change issues in the headline, but they didn't produce any evidence in the paper that it was man causing it.
Okay, look, I think you've both had your say
now. The CO2 story is based on bad physics.
You've both had your say on this.
It doesn't work.
You both had your say on this whole sort of CO2 issue and on the scientists. Now, let's look at some of the political sides to this, and that is the lobby. And I'll let you start on this one, Piers, because there obviously is quite a lot of money involved in this policy, if not even to do with things like the carbon credits. I mean, you know, that also has a big influence on where industries spring up and sometimes where they close down, because certain countries have got to so-called reduce their carbon emissions and that sort of thing. So can I ask you, Piers, first, to just talk a little bit about the lobbies that you've seen involved in this whole business of trying to persuade governments and the publics one way or the other over climate change?
Well, a very interesting one is the oil lobby. The green lobby often claim the oil lobby is against them, but that is not true. In 2004, I'd been invited along to the Global Oil Summit, which is an oil company's thing. I was surprised I was there, but I explained to them that it's the sun what does it, so to speak. And after I'd spoken, a man walked up to me and he said, "Oh, I'd just like to show you that we're on to this case." And he showed me a lot of graphs, which are very interesting, and some of them similar to mine. In other words, he agreed with what I said. And I said, "And who are you?" And he said, "Oh, I'm retiring at this meeting, but I am the chief executive of ExxonMobil." So subsequently, people asked, some of them asked ExxonMobil and others to fund our research. So I said, "Well, we won't do that unless we also ask the United Nations, who are maybe on the other side or something." So we asked them both, but the oil company said no. They didn't want to fund me, even though they liked what I said, but they don't want to upset the green lobby. That was their phrase. And you see, since then, they've been relying on the green lobby to justify increases in energy prices. And basically, they've doubled the profits on oil by keeping up energy prices in order to make it worth farmers burning food as biofuels. Those is one of the biggest interests. The other big interest group, which is likes the CO2 story, are the banks, because when there's a big CO2 anti-CO2 scheme to save the planet, such as building dams all over the Amazon basin, that involves huge amounts of money and huge profits.
Well, what about wind power, that sort of thing?
Well, wind power is more costly than coal and oil power when you include real costs. I think another important aspect of the climate lobby is things like deindustrialization of Britain, where the European Union Emissions Trading Scheme gave Tata Steel or a similar company carbon credits. When it ran down, it took over some steel industry in the north of England and ran them down, and then it gained carbon credits, and then it used those carbon credits to set up a new steel industry in India.
Okay.
And the MPs for the area asked, could they have the carbon credits applied in Britain, and they were told no. So the European Union Emission Trading Scheme, which we pay for, of course, resulted in the taxpayers of Britain paying for the destruction of industry in Britain, moving it to India, and where the same amount of CO2 is produced as before.
But surely you recognise, Piers, surely you recognise that the world's oil industry, which is one of the biggest, most powerful multinational industries in the world, has a massive vested interest in climate change denial.
No. They do not. They've got a massive interest in saying it's happening because they justify price increases. Of all the talk from the green lobby, various figures around, but mostly it's accepted that something like 2% or 5% tops is alternative forms of energy, you know, wind power, wave power, solar power and so forth. And the rest is coal and oil. So it's a no-brainer to the oil companies that they will do whatever they can to increase prices, and the green lobby does it. And if you look at the actual facts of what happened when Donald Trump withdrew America from the Paris Accords of climate, there was one person who opposed him, and that was Rex Tillerson, who up until then was the current chief executive of ExxonMobil. In other words, they know where their bread is buttered.
Dr. Joe House, you're a climate change scientist at Bristol University. Who are the big lobbies? Who is pushing for what? Because there's lots and lots of money at stake here, particularly in the energy industry.
Yeah, there's lots of money at stake in the energy industry, and there's evidence of the oil industry supporting some of the climate skeptic groups. So interestingly, one of my first experiences of working on climate change with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was back in 2003 when I worked on the third assessment report. We're now up to the fifth one and starting the cycle for the sixth one. And actually, one of the co-authors on the chapter I worked on was a scientist from ExxonMobil who was there purely as a scientist. And within that IPCC, that's not the Independent Police Complaints Commission, I'm talking about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We come in, we have to sign various things to show that we are coming not from a lobbying point of view, not with any background, that we don't have any special interest.
So how did the oil industry guy get in there?
Because he was a scientist who worked within Exxon, and he did a really excellent job on the chapter and came along and we talked about science, and he was first quality. And many of the oil companies, not all, have recognised at different times about the need to divest from fossil fuels. And it's becoming a lot more important for many of them because the whole issue of stranded assets, where the oil companies are and investors, huge investors, are beginning to realise that they might end up with coal and oil needing to be left into the ground because of climate change and the urgent need to do something about it. So you've got, big investors like Rockefeller Foundation pulling away and divesting from fossil fuels. And we've got, personally, I benefit every day from fossil fuels. I get the bus and it's run on petrol or diesel. At home I go for a renewable energy, but other places I use energy, and before that I used energy that was provided by fossil fuels. So fossil fuels and the more the energy services that they provide have had let us to have really good quality of life compared to what we would have had 100 years ago. But the point now is that there's alternatives to those fossil fuels, and the costs of wind and solar have come down really dramatically. I've been looking about solar installation on my roof, and the costs of solar have fallen, and actually now it's cheaper than some forms of fossil fuel. The cost of wind energy have come down. That's why the government had a lot of feed-in tariffs to support these industries, and they pulled them away because the costs are falling so rapidly. They feel that those tariffs have done the job and that these things are now becoming affordable. Not affordable to all your listeners. Not everyone can invest now for the savings that they'll have in over the next 10 years because it's a big upfront cost. But it is of interest that I'm sure, again, your listeners will see solar panels popping up on roofs. And that's because people who are lucky to be able to afford to invest in it realise that it's a really good investment, and that in 10 years' time they're going to be getting virtually free energy while the sun's shining, because they'll have paid off the initial costs of putting those panels on. And that's how cheap they're becoming now.
Okay, Piers, you wanted to come back up about the lobby.
Yes, the oil lobby is a key driver of the green agenda, so-called green agenda. And if you look at it, you can just go and read their websites. It's interesting to note that Grantham Institute of Climate Change, the owner of that, urges investment in the oil industry. And you can go on a website to see that. I think what we have is a false scientific, pseudo-scientific story promoted by the United Nations and the European Union, which is rather like they had their weapons of mass destruction to justify the Iraq war. Here we have a climate WMD, which relies on various interest groups, the oil industry being one, the biggest banks and Wall Street being another, and also governments that want to use it as a way of directing people what to do, but also collecting extra taxes off them.
You mentioned carbon trading there, Piers. Can you just give us an idea of what your take on the rights and wrongs of that? Because this has become almost like a sort of international currency. I noticed recently there were news reports that Prince Charles...
It's wrong, of course.
There were news reports that Prince Charles was involved financially in making money from this in the very first place, which sounds like a little bit of a abuse of his position. But what he's done is he set up a system, he's been involved in this anyway, setting up a system of allowing one part of the world to trade its carbon emissions with another part of the world. And I wonder whether you think that that's an effective system.
You see, any of these big international trading things mean that those who've got the money make more money, which means the banks or people who've got a lot. Al Gore became a millionaire on the back of the carbon trading and the false global warming, CO2-driven story. And I think a lot of the things that are coming out I would describe as fake green. Now, take electric cars. I'm not against people driving electric cars because they're quiet, you know. However, in terms of their efficiency, they're much less efficient than petrol cars, and they produce more CO2 per mile than a petrol car because of the huge amount of energy used to produce the batteries. And of course, in the end, they're electric powered, which means they're actually coal powered. So when you see, because that being the main producer of electricity, so when you see an electric car go past, remember it's actually a coal powered car.
Okay, let's just get back to the carbon trading issue. We could talk about electric cars in a minute, but Joe, what do you think that the carbon trading, is it working?
Carbon trading is only going on in limited places. So we have a carbon market in Europe. China's setting up a carbon market. Various other places are setting up a carbon market. For it to work efficiently, the price of carbon has to be quite high. And so it can work, but what you really need is you need a global market and a global price for carbon to make that work efficiently. But now we're straying into economics, which is not really so much an area of focus. But I'd really like to come back to the point about electric vehicles, because Piers is right that if the electricity is produced from fossil fuels, then it's part of the same problem. But where we start to get more of our energy mix produced from renewable energy, then that becomes part of the solution. And again, for the people of Bristol, actually, possibly even more important and immediate to them than the problem of climate change is the problem of air pollution. You know, I've raised kids in the city, and I'm sure other people have, and they read the facts that are emerging about air pollution and health and the number of excess deaths from air pollution. And electric vehicles don't produce that local air pollution. And so this is the issue for many of the solutions to climate change. The solutions are good for other reasons as well. So if we have electric vehicles, if that electricity does come more from renewable energies, as Piers quite rightly says, rather than fossil fuels, then actually, if we can solve a major inner city health problem at the same time we're supporting solving a climate change problem, then those are the sorts of solutions we need to look for. And they're available to us. And in fact, Bristol City have made quite strong commitments both about air quality and about climate change when they're talking about reducing our CO2 emissions in Bristol by 40% by 2020 and up to 80% by 2050. So the Bristol City Council has a strong commitment. They're trying to do what they can. And we as individuals can also do a lot towards that.
Do you take that point there, Piers, that by having electric cars, it enables the reduction over time of, say, for example, coal-fired power stations, and as our electricity supply generally becomes less dependent on fossil fuels, so it enables our cars also to be being driven less by fossil fuels?
Well, currently electric cars are 98% dependent or 95% dependent on fossil fuels. But because that's where electricity comes from. And the storage and then release of electricity involving batteries is very inefficient. And that's another reason why electric cars cause, more CO2. But you see, to me, CO2 is not a problem. CO2 is a good thing.
And yeah, you already said that.
The better, yes. But we should have more CO2.
Can I also...
That makes plants grow faster. and I think it's worth looking at some of the other fake green solutions, namely the Drax power station, which is burning vast amounts of wood chip, causing deforestation of parts of America. And what comes out of that is very polluting because of the low temperatures involved.
Okay, I'd also like
and
to
actually,
just get
yeah,
you...
But, you but the Drax is like increasing the number of diesel cars on British roads by 25%.
Can I just get your
Putting
take on...
Putting it back
on,
to coal would be much better.
Can I get your take on nuclear power, Piers, as well? Because many of us are being told, well, because of... too much reliance on carbon fuels, that nuclear is actually good. But they don't really seem to be talking about the dealing with nuclear waste, which is another aspect. Do you think nuclear is a good thing?
Well, I think the question is out on that, because hitherto the nuclear waste problem has been very large. Now, I don't think it has been solved, but the nuclear industry claim it has been. And I think you have to look at the disadvantages of nuclear overall. For example, the actual mining of uranium is something which is really bad.
And, okay. You know, what about you, Joe?
Child labour is used in Mali.
What's your take?
It's an open question, I would say, that one.
Joe, what's your take on nuclear?
So nuclear is a low-carbon energy source, but it has many other environmental issues and cost issues. My personal feeling might be different from every other climate scientist's personal feeling, because it's not a matter of climate science. My personal feeling is I feel very nervous about both the costs and the risks and the long-term implications of dealing with the waste from nuclear power. It is a low-carbon energy source, but I would rather we relied on some of the other low-carbon energy sources that are proving ever more efficient and dropping in cost dramatically as the industry and the technology continues to improve. But also, you know, and it's not just relying on different forms of energy, it's actually about reducing our energy. So over the last about 10 years in Bristol, Bristol's managed to reduce its CO2 by 18% and actually also reduce its energy consumption by about 20%. And that's because we can do a lot about energy efficiency, we can do a lot about insulating homes, and we can also, again, for health, and that obviously has cost benefits to people if you're spending less money on energy. And also, we talked about cars and electric vehicles and that reducing air quality issues, but also choosing to walk for short journeys where we can and the health benefits of that. Choosing to take the train instead of flying on short trips when you can. You know, I know it's not always as convenient.
Well, it's not always, you know, not always as cheap, is it?
No, it's not. It's a lot more expensive. So, you know,
when you're walking,
I think,
you're producing CO2 as well. Bear that in mind.
Okay. I think there's a lot. You would breathe, you know, you breathe in and out, and plants breathe in and out. And in a natural world, that's all in balance. But, you know, there's plenty that people can do. That you know, there's more and more. The technology's moved on, and there's lots of things we can do that benefit our health as well as benefit the environment in different ways.
Now, one of the big things that's happened over the last year is Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Let's get your take on that, first of all, Joe House. I mean, it does seem as if it took years and years and years to get everyone to agree, and the American president, Donald Trump, has sort of just really literally pulled the rug out from underneath people, because obviously everyone wants the big industrialised nations to be part of this, and he's pulled out. So why do you think he's done it, and has he done the right thing? Yeah. What's going to be the effect?
So I was in Paris for the climate agreement, and I'd been, you know, working in this area for so many years. It was overwhelming to be there, and the sense of, you know, so incredible when it got signed, and here was something scientists, hundreds and hundreds of scientists have been saying for so many years, and finally it was taken on board by all the governments agreeing, and it was just such a wonderful thing and a wonderful feeling. And then when Trump pulled out, I was crestfallen and felt really depressed. And then I saw what happened and the response to that. And the response to that was so many individuals, so many groups, so many community groups, right through to businesses and industries standing up saying, we don't want to be part of that. We still want to be part of the Paris Climate Agreement. And we are going to be a coalition of the willing, because we think it's important enough and we think it's doable, and that we're willing to stay committed to that despite what President Trump said. And that was incredible. And that movement is so strong now. California, I think, just this week announced that they're a target to become net zero, a kind of balance of CO2. So, you know, whatever they still have to emit in order to feed people and other things, they will find other ways of taking it out, for example, by planting trees. So, you know, California as a state has made a commitment, and, you know, some really big industries, Unilever and Apple and others, have all made commitments to continue because they believe the science and because they think it's important and because they think it's doable.
So, Piers, what's your take on Trump? Was he right to pull out of this Paris climate?
Well, he was completely right to pull out, and he stood up to the mainstream media lobby, which is backed by Wall Street. And I think it was an excellent thing he did, and it looks like some other countries are thinking of following suit. What we're going to have now, I think, is the collapse of the climate story, which actually, the CO2 scam is delusional nonsense. And what we're going to see is a continuing cooling into very serious cooling in the next two decades, which will be reasonably described in winter times as a mini ice age.
But Piers, I mean...
And the CO2 theory has failed to predict anything. But, in fact, all its predictions have failed.
But Trump is really being castigated for pulling out of almost every international agreement, including...
Well, okay, I'm not talking about anything else Trump does. You asked me about this. If you told me it's... Suppose I didn't like you, which isn't the case, of course, and you told me it was Tuesday, and I might say, well, if you say it's Tuesday, it must be Wednesday. Now, look, come on, let's get sensible. I'm saying that what Trump has done on climate issues, in particular the Paris Accord, is good and a advance for evidence-based science.
Piers Corbyn and Dr. Joe House from Bristol University, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it in MP3 from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Dr. Joe House of Bristol University and Piers Corbyn of weatheraction.com, and also to presenter Tony Gosling. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prc.org.uk. You can talk to PRC Arts Centre on 0117 909 6897. That's 909 6897. Or the China Shop on 9444 540. That's 9444 540. Volunteer with us if you like, or hundreds of other opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. I'm David Bazanko. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now. To be
good. Sol, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea. Northerly, 4 to 6, Lindley 7, decreasing 3 or 4, Lindley 5. Showers at first, good. Showers.